We continue our series this evening in the book of Kings. If you've been keeping track, you'll notice that the pastors are now competing to see who can preach on the longest passage of Kings. I haven't checked the word count yet, but I think I'm in the running. Now, the text in the bulletin is a little deceiving. The first few verses we're not going to pull from, but it is a long passage. I'll explain why as we get started here. But the last time that we were in Kings, Pastor White highlighted how, in many ways, 1 Kings chapter 8 was sort of the pinnacle of Solomon's reign, the high point of the glory of his kingship. The temple is glorious, the worship is extravagant, God is exalted, Solomon prays faithfully. Chapter 8 is an incredible high point in the history of Israel and in Solomon's reign in particular. But then, in chapter 11, in terms of what's coming, just 57 verses later, that's going to mark a low point. If you don't already know, chapter 11 is Solomon's fall before the Lord. In chapter 11, we will read about how Solomon turned away from the Lord, from Yahweh, the God of Israel, and that his heart turned towards false gods. And God, as a result, will tear 10 tribes of the kingdom from Solomon's descendants. And from that moment on, things in 1 and 2 Kings will never again reach the level they were back in chapter 8. We have a great high, and then we have a terrible low. Our text tonight really is about what happened in between. It's a long text, and it stretches from the midpoint of Solomon's reign, when Solomon, to the point then when Solomon was in his later years. And what we'll see in those intervening years is both the incredible success of Solomon's achievements, as well as the incredible danger that he invites into his life. The achievements are trumpeted in these chapters, but mixed in with the success, there are some red flags. Some of you may catch some of them at first as you read, but others you may not notice at first. They're things we need to reflect on to see more clearly, and maybe that's part of the point. It would be a mistake to miss all the success that we see here because of the red flags, but it would also be a mistake to miss the red flags because of all the success. We need to see both. That's true when it comes to Solomon. It's also true when we look at the world around us, the way certain ministries or organizations might work, the way other people might operate their lives, the way we ourselves live our life. We need to cultivate eyes to see both the real success and achievements that are gifts from God, and also to see the real dangers which God calls us to identify and then actively guard against. Solomon fails to do that second piece here. But the author of Kings, I think, calls us to consider these things in our own lives as we look at Solomon. I've printed, as I mentioned, the first 9 verses of chapter 9 in the bulletin for your reference. Pastor White covered those last week, but the categories introduced there of both promise and warning will be key for how we understand what follows, so it's there for you to refer back to. But with that said, we'll turn now to our text. As I said, it's a longer one. There's a lot that happens, but I encourage you to be listening to those achievements and to maybe be looking for those red flags too, as we hear from 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 10, through 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 29. And as we hear from it, please do listen carefully. This is God's word for us this evening. There we read, at the end of 20 years in which Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord, the house of Yahweh, and the king's house. And Hiram, king of Tyre, had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress timber and gold as much as he desired. King Solomon gave to Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. But when Hiram came from Tyre to see the cities that Solomon had given him, they did not please him. Therefore he said, "What kind of cities are these that you have given me, my brother?" So they are called the land of Kabul to this day. Hiram had sent the king 120 talents of gold. And this is the account of the forced labor that King Solomon drafted to build the house of Yahweh and the house and his own house and the Millo and the wall of Jerusalem and Hazor and Megiddo and Gezer. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and captured Gezer and burned it with fire and had killed the Canaanites who lived in the city and had given it as a dowry to his daughter Solomon's wife. So Solomon rebuilt Gezer. And lower Beth-horam, and Baalath, and Tamar, and the wilderness in the land of Judah. and all the store cities that Solomon had, and the cities for his chariots, and the cities for his horsemen, and whatever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. All the people who were left of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, who were not of the people of Israel, their descendants who were left after them in the land, whom the people of Israel were unable to devote to destruction, these Solomon drafted to be slaves, and so they are to this day. But of the people of Israel, Solomon made no slaves. They were the soldiers, they were his officials, his commanders, his captains, his chariot commanders, and his horsemen. These were the chief officers who were over Solomon's work, 550 who had charge of the people and who carried on the work. But Pharaoh's daughter went up from the city of David to her own house that Solomon had built for her. Then he built the Millo. 3 times a year, Solomon used to offer up burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar that he built to Yahweh, making offerings with it before Yahweh. So he finished the house. King Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is near Eloth in the shore of the Red Sea, in the land of Edom. And Hiram sent with the fleet his servants, seamen who were familiar with the sea, together with servants of Solomon. And they went to Ophir and brought from there gold, 420 talents, and they brought it to King Solomon. Now when the queen of Sheba heard the fame of Solomon concerning the name of Yahweh, she came to test him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels bearing spices and very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind. And Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. And when the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his officials, and the attendance of his servants, their clothing, his cupbearers, and his burnt offerings that he offered in the house of Yahweh, there was no more breath in her. And she said to the king, "The report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and of your wisdom. But I did not believe the reports until I came and my own eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpassed the report that I heard. Happy are your men. Happy are your servants who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be Yahweh your God, who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because Yahweh loved Israel forever, for he has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness." Then she gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great quantity of spices and precious stones. Never again came such an abundance of spices as these that the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Moreover, the fleet of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought from Ophir a very great amount of almug wood and precious stones. And the king made of the almug wood supports for the house of Yahweh and for the king's house, also lyres and harps for the singers. No such almug wood has come or been seen to this day. And King Solomon gave to the queen of Sheba all that she desired, whatever she asked beside what was given to her by the bounty of King Solomon. So she turned and went back to her own land with her servants. Now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold, beside that which came from the explorers and from the business of the merchants and from all the kings of the west and from the governors of the land. Solomon made 200 large shields of beaten gold. 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. And he made 300 shields of beaten gold. 3 minas of gold went into each shield. And the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. The king also made a great ivory throne and overlaid it with the finest gold. The throne had 6 steps, and the throne had a round top, and on each side of the seat were armrests and 2 lions standing beside the armrests, while 12 lions stood there, 1 on each end of a step on the 6 steps. The like of it was never made in any kingdom. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None were silver. Silver was not considered anything in the days of Solomon. For the king had a fleet of ships of Tarshish at the sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the fleet of ships of Tarshish used to come bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. Thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. Every one of them brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, myrrh, spices, horses, and mules, so much year by year. And Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities and with the king of Jerusalem, in Jerusalem. And the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone, and he made cedar as plentiful as the sycamore of the Shephelah. And Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt and Kew, and the king's traders received them from Kew at a price. A chariot could be imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. And so, through the king's traders, they were exported to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. This is the word of the Lord. So as verse 10 points out, our text starts in the second half of Solomon's reign, 20 years after he has taken the throne, and it describes for us what happens from there. As I said, I think we see in this passage that Solomon achieves incredible success while simultaneously inviting and even embracing incredible danger. First, let's consider Solomon's incredible success. Now, at a surface level, we can very easily see Solomon's earthly success here, right? I don't need to repeat all the things that we just heard in that very long passage. It doesn't need much comment if we're paying attention. The author of Kings tells us all about the power and the wealth and the influence and the renown that Solomon has garnered for himself. All of this is helpful in assessing Solomon. The author puts it before us. But also, as we're thinking of this passage and what's come before it in 1 Kings, we're reminded that a faithful Israelite would be even more interested in a different kind of success for Solomon. He'd be even more interested in Solomon's, we might say, covenantal success, in how Solomon was doing as God's instrument in bringing about what God had promised to Israel if they were faithful. And to see what God has promised to Israel and to assess Solomon in these terms from this passage and a few before it, we need to go back to Genesis 12. There, God made a covenant, a promise to Abraham, the father of all Israel. And he said to him, "Go from your country and from your kindred and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." This is God's covenant with Abraham. This forms the foundations of so much of what follows in the Bible. And in it we see that God promises Abraham five things. He promises to give him the promised land, to make him a great nation, to bless him and be with him, to bless his friends and curse his enemies, and finally, to bless all families of the earth through Abraham's descendants. Five things are promised to Israel in the covenant with Abraham. And then in 2 Samuel 7, God adds a sixth thing. There he promises to raise up a descendant of David who will reign on the throne of Israel forever. So taken together, we have these six covenant promises. First, the land. Second, to make Abraham a great nation. Third, to bless Israel and be with them. Fourth, to bless Israel's friends and curse their enemies. Fifth, to bless all families of the earth through Abraham's children. And then sixth, an eternal king on the throne. Six promises, and to truly evaluate the success of Israel under Solomon's leadership, we need to evaluate how things are going according to these six criteria. Let's take them one at a time. Let's start with the promise to make Abraham a great nation. In Genesis 22, God puts the promise like this. He says to Abraham, "I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore." That's the covenant promise. And then in 1 Kings 3:8, we read that Israel is a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude. In 1 Kings 4:20, we're told Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. In other words, the promise to make Abraham a great nation has, in many ways, been fulfilled under Solomon. Solomon is experiencing in this area incredible covenant success. Next is the promise of the land. In Genesis 15, 18, God says to Abraham, to your offspring I will give this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. Then in 1 Kings 4, 21, we're told Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms of the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and the border of Egypt. It's the same geographic location. Solomon is ruling over the land that God has promised to Abraham. Again, on this second count, Solomon is experiencing incredible covenantal success. Then there's the promise to bless Abraham's descendants and to be with them. We see this reiterated in Genesis 17. And we see it fulfilled in the dedication of the temple in 1 Kings 9, especially 1 through 3, where God promises to put his name on the temple and to put his eyes and his heart there forever in the midst of Israel. And with that promise and with the completion of the temple, this third promise seems in many ways to be fulfilled too. God says he will be with his people. He will bless them with his presence. And so again, Solomon, in carrying these deeds out, is experiencing incredible covenantal success on this third element. Then there's the promise to bless Israel's friends and to curse their enemies, which is reiterated in Genesis 22, which speaks of God's people possessing the gates of their enemies, having authority over them. Well, we read in 1 Kings 4, 24 and 25, how Solomon had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tiphath to Gaza, over all the kings west of the Euphrates. And he had peace on all sides around him, it says. And Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, all the days of Solomon. In addition, here in our text in chapter 9, verses 15 through 22, we read of Solomon's dominion over the people of the land. Clearly, Solomon is reigning over his enemies. He has peace. There's no real threat. And so again, in this fourth promise of the covenant, Solomon is experiencing incredible covenantal success. Then there's God's promise to bless all families of the earth through Abraham's descendants. In Genesis 22:18, God says to Abraham, "In your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed." And in 1 Kings, we seem to be seeing even this come to pass. In 1 Kings 5, we read about how Hiram was blessed by Solomon's reign. Here, in 1 Kings 10, verse 9, we read of how the Queen of Sheba was blessed by Solomon and how she responds by blessing Yahweh, the God of Israel. And then in verse 24, we read, "And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind." Solomon is blessing the nations, not only with wisdom, but with the knowledge of the Lord, the knowledge of Yahweh. And so once again, on this fifth promise, Solomon is experiencing incredible covenantal succession. Finally, there's the promise to David of an eternal dynasty. God says to David, "I will raise up your offspring after you who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever." And it's worth thinking, just imagining at least, if we didn't know what was coming, then as we hear that promise and as we see Solomon's success, we might begin to wonder if Solomon is the one who will sit on Israel's throne, maybe forever. As we think of the promises God has made, we may even go all the way back to Genesis 3:15 and wonder if Solomon could be the one to crush the head of the evil serpent, Satan. After all, God seems to be fulfilling all these other promises of the covenant through him. We can leave that question there and come back to it, but let's acknowledge that Solomon is experiencing incredible success, not just in a worldly way, though he is doing that, but in a covenantal way as well, in a spiritual way. So much so that if we didn't know the rest of the story, we would have to wonder whether Solomon might be the promised one of God. That's how great his success is. Each of these promises is being fulfilled. Solomon achieves incredible success, and we need to see that in these chapters. But then, at the very same time, the author of Kings signals to us that Solomon is also inviting incredible danger. The Lord warns of just this in chapter 9, verse 4 through 9. He warns of what will happen if Solomon turns from him. And how might Solomon do that? What would it look like for Solomon to turn from the Lord? Well, there might be a number of ways that he could do that, but chief among them would be if Solomon were to break God's laws for the kings of Israel. And we find God's laws for the king summarized in Deuteronomy 17. There, Moses writes this. He says, "When you come to the land that Yahweh your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, 'I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me,' you may indeed set a king over you whom Yahweh your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since Yahweh has said to you, 'You shall never return that way again.' And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold." This is God's law for the king. This is what Solomon must do. But as we look at our text this evening, the red flags start to appear. In chapter 10, verse 14, we read, "Now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold." That's a lot of gold. And from there, it goes on to talk about all the things Solomon made of gold and how all of his drinking vessels were of gold, of how silver was so plentiful it wasn't even counted. But in Deuteronomy 17, Moses says of the king that he shall not acquire excessive silver and gold. Solomon seems to have broken God's commandment here. Nothing has come of it yet, but he seems to be inviting incredible danger by violating this prohibition. A few verses later, in verse 26, we read that Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen whom he stationed in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. In verse 28 and 29, we're told, "And Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt. A chariot could be imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. But again, in Deuteronomy 17, Moses wrote that the king must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since Yahweh has said to you, 'You shall never return that way again.'" But Solomon has returned that way again. He's acquired many horses and chariots, and he's gone to Egypt to do it. That's two violations out of the three major commands here for the king. The third, we'll hear about more in the next chapter, chapter 11, of course. But even beyond the warnings of Deuteronomy 17, there are other red flags in this passage. Israel is supposed to be a blessing to all nations, but in chapter 9, verses 11 through 14, we see that Hiram feels shortchanged. As one commentator puts it, instead of causing Yahweh's name and generosity to be praised among the Gentiles, Solomon damages Yahweh's reputation with Hiram. And then as we look at that closer, we realize that the choice of compensation from Solomon also seems problematic. Remember, a key promise of the covenant was that God would give Israel the land, and Israel would dwell in it. But here, Solomon is giving the land to Hiram, and Hiram was a Canaanite. As one commentator puts it, Solomon sells 20 cities of Galilee for 120 talents of gold. Instead of extending the conquest, Solomon reverses it, and a portion of the land falls back into the hands of Gentiles, Canaanites no less. Then in verse 16, we see that Pharaoh is doing what Solomon should be doing. He's taking the land as part of the conquest. And as sort of a reversal, in verse 19, Solomon is acting sort of like Pharaoh has in the past, building storehouses, just as it was highlighted in Exodus chapter 1 that Pharaoh forced the Israelites to do. And as we read on in chapter 10, verse 29, we learn that Solomon not only imported horses and chariots from Egypt from himself in violation of Deuteronomy 17, but then he sold these military assets to the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. The Hittites were Canaanites. Assyria would go on to be a constant threat to Israel in the century that followed. Solomon, we learn here, is profiting in part by arming his enemies, the Canaanites and the Syrians. And as for what he did with those prophets, as Ian Provan points out, unlike earlier descriptions a few chapters before, which spoke not only of Solomon's prosperity, but the prosperity of the common people as well, back in chapter 4, here in chapters 9 and 10, there's a notable absence of any word about the prosperity of the common people. The text here is all about the luxury of Solomon's court. Then there's Pharaoh's daughter, who should also be a red flag for us. Faithful Israelites were forbidden to marry foreigners, not ethnic foreigners or racial foreigners, but religious foreigners. Unlike with the Queen of Sheba, there's no word of Pharaoh's daughters proclaiming her faith in Yahweh, the God of Israel, which seems to imply that Solomon is marrying unbelievers, as chapter 11 will soon confirm. And of course, in chapter 11, we get into Solomon's third violation of Deuteronomy 17. And with that, Solomon's downfall will come as his heart is led astray. But part of what we need to see here is that that final step in Solomon's downfall that comes in the next chapter, it didn't actually come out of nowhere. If all we see is Solomon's success in chapters 9 and 10, then we might feel like Solomon's fall in chapter 11 is abrupt and sort of out of the blue. But God makes it clear here that there were multiple red flags throughout chapters 9 and 10, even as those same chapters were filled with the signs of Solomon's covenantal success. Solomon achieved incredible success, and at the very same time, he invited incredible danger. And in the end, the danger he embraced brought him down. But here's the tricky thing for us. Solomon both achieved incredible success as Israel's king using the wisdom God had given him, and he embraced incredible danger that eventually fractured the kingdom, and he did these two things at the very same time. That's the shocking and difficult and also very important lesson for us to see in Solomon. And it's something I think we often struggle with. We're told of Solomon's wisdom. The Bible's emphatic about it. But it's also, the Bible's also emphatic about Solomon's failure. And it's hard to know how to hold those two things together. We sort of want it to be all one or all the other. You may even hear that tension at times in our sermons in this series so far. We often want to tell either a story of great success until there's a surprise fall at the end, or a story of obvious trouble and failure from the beginning. But the Bible doesn't force us into one of those options. In fact, the Bible tells us, especially in our text tonight, that it really was both at the same time, as confounding as that may be to us. Here, Peter Leithart, in his commentary on Kings, is worth quoting at length. Leithart puts it like this. He writes, Solomon reaches the heights of political and cultural attainments, develops creativity in all spheres and endeavor, yet his cultivations and energy are ultimately directed towards finding new ways to violate Yahweh's covenant with Israel. But then Leithart goes on. He says, simplistic moralisms are out of place in this passage, however. Solomon's wisdom and well-deserved fame increase and remain with him at the very time that he begins violating the laws of kingship. Wisdom does not flit away as Solomon begins to multiply horses, chariots, and women. The same chapter that documents Solomon's accumulation of gold informs us that he is greater than all the kings of the earth in wisdom, and that his wisdom is of such quality that kings come to hear about it. These are not ironic evaluations. Assessing Solomon would be infinitely easier if the narrator told us that he became a fool. But Solomon remains wise, and Solomon the sage breaks the word of Yahweh. Wise Solomon remains wise even while he abandons the fear of Yahweh, which is the beginning of wisdom. Solomon's life does not narrate the simple truism that even a wise person can fail. Rather, it shows a wise man who fails precisely at the height of his wisdom. Precisely at the moment when everyone acknowledges his wisdom, indeed precisely in the exercise of this wisdom. Leithart continues, the Book of Kings is, among other things, wisdom literature. And the life of Solomon demonstrates that wisdom does not allow the wise to rest on their laurels and coast through life. Wisdom requires guarding one's steps. And the wiser one is, the more skilled one is, the more paths are open, the more options. The wise can accomplish things that a fool cannot, and this means that the wise faces peculiar temptations, temptations that are simply not available to the fool. With success, and not only with success, but with skill and with wisdom comes new dangers. And the story of Solomon is a story for us to be on guard, not just in our low moments, but maybe especially when we or others are at the height of our powers. In some sense, part of this lesson can maybe be summed up with the words of the Apostle Paul when he writes, "Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed, lest he fall." In Solomon's case, the red flags were there. But I wonder if anyone really noticed them at the time. Because of all his success, because of all his skill, because of all of his very real wisdom, did anyone see the red flags at the time? Or did those just sort of get lost in the blur of Solomon's success? Did Solomon really see the red flags? Or had he blinded himself to them as well? And I wonder if anyone had pointed those red flags out to Solomon, especially those violations of Deuteronomy 17, would Solomon have listened? Of course, we don't know. But the proverb of Proverbs 16:12 comes to mind as we think about it. There we read, "Do you see a man who is wise in his own eyes? There is more hope for a fool than for him." That is a proverb of Solomon. I do wonder if he took it to heart. Of course, there are many modern examples of success and wisdom mixed with sin leading to downfall. We might think of Mark Driscoll or in Mars Hill or of Ravi Zacharias and the collapse of his ministry. Success and wisdom combined with sin and rebellion. Many other ministry leaders, of course, could be named. And of course, there are examples of this pattern far beyond ministry leaders. But maybe the issue is more stark when it comes to leaders of Christian ministries. What's heartbreaking in Solomon's case and in so many others is that the success doesn't mitigate the guilt of their sin. It doesn't lessen it. If anything, it actually makes it worse. Because with such powers and in such a position, their sin does even more damage. And because they truly should have known better, their guilt is that much more heavy. In assessing them, as the Bible does with Solomon, the good and the bad are not put on a scale so that if they're good enough, it makes the bad okay. But rather far from that, the good, the skill, the wisdom, the success of Solomon makes the sin and rebellion all the more weighty. Solomon falls, and he falls hard, in part because of his great wisdom. And so we are reminded here that we must be on guard. We should seek wisdom. We should seek success, both in common earthly terms, but especially in spiritual terms. But we should know that wisdom and success will not free us from temptations. If anything, they may open up new kinds of temptations. That's the nature of life in this fallen world. As we heard from Peter Lighthart earlier, the life of Solomon demonstrates that wisdom does not allow the wise to rest on their laurels and coast through life. Wisdom requires guarding one's steps, and the wiser one is, the more skilled one is, the more paths are open, the more options. And so, we might add with that, the more seriously one must guard their own steps, the more seriously one must examine their own motives, the more seriously one must doubt their own hearts, the more seriously one must seek accountability and input and counsel from others, others who are willing to speak hard truths to us. If you're a Christian, then part of your calling as you grow and mature is to grow in wisdom and skill. But you also need to ask yourself as you do that, as you grow, how will you guard your steps? I think too often we act and we think as if we need counsel and input and accountability when we're young. But then as we grow older and wiser, we can discard those things. When we're young, we should doubt ourselves, but when we're older, we should have self-confidence. But Solomon's life really counters those assumptions. I wonder how Solomon's story would have been different if he had had a little more self-doubt. I wonder how Solomon's story would have been different if he had sought input and accountability from others. I don't know. His story now is what it is. But our story is still going. And the story of Solomon exhorts us not to make the same mistake he did. Not to be lulled into self-confidence, not to be wise in our own eyes, not to fall as we think we are standing firm. Even if we're experiencing great success and others are coming to us for wisdom, even in such moments, especially in such moments, we must guard our steps and seek the input of others who will help us to do that. The story of Solomon calls us to guard our steps. That's key to our text this evening. But finally, the story of Solomon should not only prompt us to guard our steps, it should also prompt us to seek Jesus. Earlier on, as we considered Solomon's great covenantal success, I mentioned how, if we did not know what was coming in chapter 11, we would maybe start to ask, is Solomon the eternal king promised to David? Is Solomon the one to crush the serpent's head promised to Eve? With Solomon's fall, the author of Kings answers those questions with a decisive no. But that no, then, should cause us to long all the more for the one who will fulfill that role. One more time, as Leithart puts it, successful as he is, Solomon does not bring in a perpetual golden age. Human wisdom cannot bring in salvation for a fallen Israel or a fallen humanity. That can only be done through God's wisdom in flesh, a wisdom that confounds the wisdom of the wise, a wisdom that looks for all the world like folly. Wisdom is a precious thing. We should seek wisdom earnestly, like Solomon did. But with it, we must continue to guard our steps. We must continue to be watchful against the sinfulness of our own hearts and all the ways that we can be tempted to misuse the wisdom and the skill that we get. Seek wisdom, guard your steps, and place your hope in Jesus. Because it will not ultimately be our wisdom or our vigilance that saves us, but rather Jesus's power and love. Jesus, who was what Solomon was hoped to be. Jesus can keep us from sin, and Jesus can cleanse and restore us when we've already fallen into sin. He is the one promised long ago. He is the one who is stronger than even our sin. He is the one who will keep hold of us if we put our faith in him. He is the one who can give us forgiveness, and he is the one who will bring all the promises of the covenant to pass. Amen.